I'll give you a price target. Here you go. Global GDP divided by 21 million. Because that, you know, I love the infinity by 21 million. And here's where I define infinity. It's the potential production and creativity of humanity, right? It's the human element within the variable that can create and innovate, that drives value into the economy. So the limit on creativity is infinite. But ultimately, Bitcoin can fully represent global GDP divided by 21 million. Like you said, this is not a risk on tech stock. This is the most pristine form of collateral in the world. This is engineered money. And when we incorporate it into our credit and debt markets, we can get the lowest interest rates in the world and attract tremendous amounts of liquidity from really highly qualified borrowers. The first country and the first states to do this are going to see a tremendous influx of demand for their debt notes and for their securities, because it's not only from the lender side, it's from the borrower side too. It, like I said earlier, it's that engineered money. There was strategic design into the protocol itself to literally leverage the natural laws of economics to drive value into the network. This means it's an engineered money. And the engineered solution is always better than the natural solution. We had, what do we used to use? Candles, then we went to a light bulb. Then we had horse, and then we had horsepower in the engine. So when you go from natural to engineered, it's always an upgrade. And Bitcoin is engineered money. It's the upgrade from the natural form of the money for all the reasons we spoke about today.
All right, phenomenal. Well, CJ, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You know, I've been following your stuff for a while. We just talked beforehand. Turns out you've been following my stuff for a while. So two big fans of each other finally getting to sit down and talk. And in my mind, there's no better time to be talking about it. You're a Bitcoin is pristine collateral guy. I am myself. And I know it's something we haven't really hit on with our viewers in quite some time. We talked about it several months ago. Peter Dunworth was on the show. He was talking about, in the system, the debt itself isn't the problem. It's the collateral that's the problem, right? The amount of debt we have isn't necessarily the problem. I know you've spoken in the past about how on the start of your orange pill journey down the rabbit hole, you first thought, all right, we have to get rid of banks. As you went further down the rabbit hole, you began understanding that it's not actually the problem. The problem isn't debt itself. It's the way that banks are writing these loans and extending credit. So I want you to expand upon that a little bit. What's the problem with our current system? Why is it a debt problem? Why is it a collateral problem and not a problem with lending itself?
Yeah. And that's been a recent orange pill revelation of mine, probably in the last three years or so when I started building People's Reserve. Because what I realized was, you know, there's nothing wrong with banking, but it's fractional reserve banking. It's the practices of rehypothecation and having multiple claims against single owned assets that creates all of the problems within the system. This is why you need like the bank term funding program, because you can get into a situation where the assets are actually less than the liabilities. And we're allowing this to happen. So after I started doing more research and really starting to understand, you know, how do you have a credit market on Bitcoin? Because that's a, you know, you hear a lot of solid arguments about a Bitcoin credit doesn't make sense. And it doesn't make sense. You really don't want to issue Bitcoin denominated debt, because you're pretty much going to bankrupt yourself. You're talking about 60% CAGR. And even if in the long run that gets cut in half, or even gets cut even more than that, and you got a 20% CAGR, what's the interest rate going to be? It's going to be 20% plus a borrow premium. And right now it should be, you know, 60% plus a borrow premium if you're going to borrow Bitcoin directly. But people have figured it out. You don't borrow Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is money. And it's not just some form of money, like a natural money like gold or silver. It's engineered money. It was strategically designed to leverage the natural laws of economics and commodity cycles and price discovery to empower the people that hold it. So money is a tool, and it's like a hammer. But we also have this tool that is currency, which is like the nail. And when you use currency and money together, and currency being these fiat debt derivatives, right? They always say Bitcoin's not backed by anything. Yes, it is backed by proof of work. There's no proof of work to type in a number into a ledger and expand the amount of debt derivatives in the system. They can do it whenever they want and for whatever reason they want. We saw that since 2020, and it's been accelerating. So when you have something that is a currency that is being continuously diluted and losing purchasing power, and you can borrow that against a pristine form of collateral that accrues value by design, the magic really starts to happen. And I think the biggest thing in the system that the bankers are missing is that they're so used to this fractional reserve lending model where they get to create dollars out of thin air and then use people's assets as a way to generate profit for themselves within their own business model. So the business model really creates its own leverage, and it's the opposite. It paints an opposite picture of what Bitcoin is. So when you talk about Bitcoin credit, just based on Bitcoin, it doesn't really make that much sense. What's wrong with 60% CAGR? Just save. You don't need credit. In a couple of years, you'll be able to build that business or make that investment because the purchasing power is going to be there for you. You don't need to lend it out and earn interest. The interest is earned through the performance of the asset itself. But when you borrow currency against the money, all of a sudden, you're like an elite because you're auto deleveraging. The value of your debt is being deleveraged against the value of your current of your money. So it creates this magic moment where you can actually be empowered by taking on debt, which a lot of people hear that and they're like, no, no, debt is bad. Debt is bad. They've just been trained to think that debt is bad.
They've been hypnotized by Dave Ramsey.
Yeah. I mean, you know, pay off. You got a mortgage at 2.5%, pay it off, right? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, you obviously don't want to do that because the debt is an asset. And what makes me upset, what gets me a little bit frustrated is that that's not the natural laws of economics. The natural laws of economics don't create those incentives where you add debt. And the system's been flipped upside down. And that's because the biggest borrowers in the system are actually the governments and the banks. So when we deposit our money at a bank, it's our asset, but it's their liability. We're lending it to them. And that's why they pay us interest. So, you know, there might be around $18 trillion of demand deposits within the system. And then when you look at the government, they've run up $36 trillion of debt. There's another $220 trillion of unfunded liabilities, which is just a significant amount of money being borrowed. So, of course, the powers that be, who are the largest borrowers in the world, have flipped these incentives upside down to make it sense to borrow and not make sense to lend. So when we, you know, at People's Reserve, what we see here is we have to make lending make sense again. That's what we say. We have to figure out a way where you're actually incentivized to save your money, because the only way you would save your money is if the real rate of return was positive. And it's only the performance of Bitcoin that creates this positive rate of return. We're seeing this all over the markets, Joe. In insurance, I mean, insurance is they're in the worst position they've been in a couple hundred years because of what just happened with all these natural disasters adding up, and with the rise in interest rates, because during the zero interest rate policy, they were forced out the yield curve to get any yield at all. And then all of a sudden, 10 years later, when they're buying 20-year bonds, the interest rates get racketed up the fastest they've ever been in percentage terms in the history of finance, and they lose all that mark-to-market value, but they still have claims coming in. There's hurricanes, there's fires, there's all these things happening, and these debt notes are paying 3 to 5% APY. Meanwhile, the rise in prices is going up 10, 15, 20%. The cost of replacement for some of the real estate in California, you're seeing $3 and $4 million homes that cannot be replaced unless you're going to be willing to spend $6 to $8 million. And that's without taking into account all of the extra demand that's going to be happening at the same time for this basket of commodities that is what we call a home or real estate. So the insurance companies are like, wow, we're collecting premiums, we're buying debt, the debt's yielding 5%, but the cost of replacement is going up 10%. We're losing 5% year over year. We better hope and pray something doesn't happen or we're going to be screwed. And unfortunately, some bad things and catastrophes have happened. So our hearts go out to those people who have been affected, especially to those who lived in government zones that didn't allow the insurance companies to increase the rates to what they calculated it that they needed it to be to offer the insurance. So now they're there facing this problem with no solution, with no coverage and no way to rebuild and restart. And it all goes back to these problems. It all goes back to understanding that fractional reserve banking is a very dangerous practice. And it's a dangerous practice that results in real negative rates of return because of the eventual abuse of the expansion of the currency supply. And that's why Bitcoin is a godsend, because there's absolute digital scarcity. It was engineered that way. It's better than gold, because gold is a natural money that has a limited supply, that is hard to bring the supply out of the ground because of the cost, because of the proof of work that's required to expand the supply. So it offered some type of protection. However, with Bitcoin, there's no mercy. It's absolute digital scarcity. So when people want more of it, there's only one way to make the supply hit the market, and that's making the price go up. And when we leverage that dynamic into debt and credit products, we can actually empower the borrower. And at the same time, we can reduce risk for the lender. So I see it as a win-win scenario, but definitely a big orange pill for the market to swallow.
And you know, today, we're kind of on the cusp of three different changes, but two major changes as it pertains to Bitcoin functioning as collateral. The biggest one, perhaps, is the repeal of SAB 121. This has been, you know, this edict that's been imposed on banks. Basically, you know, it's not an official law, but it's basically the SEC putting forward a bulletin that says, hey, if you try to custody Bitcoin on behalf of your clients, we're going to audit you. We're going to make it nearly impossible to do this. We're probably going to shut down your business. And so it dissuaded a lot of these banks from custodying Bitcoin. And when you custody Bitcoin, you can create financial products on top of it. You could use it as collateral for lending. You could offer Bitcoin-backed loans, etc. Now SAB 121 has been repealed. Talk about some of the implications of banks being able to custody Bitcoin and how this is going to be transformative for credit markets. I'm of the view, and I wrote a piece that actually went live yesterday. It was like a 15, 60 minute long post that kind of delved into all this, that it will increase the quality of credit. It will make interest rates better because they will be more individualized instead of set by this centralized entity. And it's going to improve capital efficiency, right? Because with a higher quality collateral, you don't need as much excessive over collateralization. And so it's going to allow these high quality loans to be extended faster. Talk a little bit about how transformative it is for banks to be able to custody Bitcoin and kind of financialize on top of it.
Yeah. So this, and I think that was really great synopsis there, because what we're seeing is the financialization, or what I like to call the monetization of Bitcoin as an asset class. This is the this is like what happened to real estate after 71. So you got rid of the convertibility into gold, and then all of a sudden real estate as collateral started accelerating. And we financialized the real estate asset class, which turned it into the kind of asset that it is today. You know, prices, there's such a premium to the utility value of real estate right now, because it's a way that you can get short on the dollar. You can add leverage to your position by leveraging against your real estate properties, because the banks had acknowledged it as a form of collateral. Now, maybe not pristine collateral like you see in treasuries, because of certain credit risk and liquidity risk and the difficulty in finding an accurate market price relative to comparables and other stuff like that. So there's a big swing in how you value the collateral versus a treasury, which is why the treasury holds that pristine collateral position. But no doubt behind treasuries, real estate is probably the most important form of collateral within the system. So what we saw was a massive amount of value being driven into that asset class because of the financialization of the asset class. And that's what we're seeing right now with Bitcoin with our own eyes. And this is the banks here saying, hey, look, we're going to custody this. And now we can custody this, right? SAB 121 was about the banks, if they wanted to take that risk, add that risk onto the book, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But if they wanted to add that risk, really, they were accounting for it as a liability. And they had to back that liability with a certain apportioned amount of assets, and even just to hold it on their book. So it created this pool of capital that could not be allocated into whatever gambling or allocation model that specific bank uses, because it had to back that asset one-to-one. They rather have 1 penny or 10 cents backing a dollar and using the 90 cents to go make money for themselves in whatever market-making opportunities they're taking advantage of. So with Bitcoin, you couldn't do that. Now with Bitcoin, you're going to be able to do that, which I think creates a little bit of another risk, really. So SAB 122 comes out and says, you know, okay, now you can hold Bitcoin and you just have to follow the reserve requirements and make sure that you're adhering to Basel banking policies, so that when you structure your risk portfolios, you're accounting for these swings in values and you're doing this the right way. However, what happens is the practices of fractional reserve banking and the practices of rehypothecation, to me, it's like a hard habit that you can't break. Once you get the free money faucet, you really don't let it go. It's why we call the helicopter money phased, which the US dollar is now in, typically signaling the end of the currency's life cycle. Because once you get to the point where it's just helicopter money out there, that's the end. That's historically been the signal for the end of the currency's life cycle. And the banks, They started this process. They're the ones who moved into fractional reserve banking and create what's called circulating credit. And circulating credit is credit that is not backed by any reserve. It's not a deposit of a customer being lent out to another customer looking to borrow. It's simply inflation, because banks and governments are the only two entities in the world that can create inflation. And what they're going to try to do, I think, is mimic that same strategy and model in order to increase profitability with Bitcoin. But what that does is it rehypothecates the Bitcoin, and it creates multiple claims against that Bitcoin, which is still a liability on their balance sheet. So, you know, are we going to need another bank term funding program? And this time it's going to need to, you know, be for $1 trillion, because the banks need to come and, I mean, they're not going to be able to post Bitcoin collateral because they rehypothecated it, and whoever had that claim made that claim. You can't print more Bitcoin. So I think there's a lot of, it's exciting to see that Bitcoin is being financialized and it's being monetized. We've gone from magic internet money to digital gold to reserve asset of the internet economy to now pristine collateral. We are watching the monetization of the asset class. It's 15 years. So relative to monetary history, the speed at which this is moving is insane. So keep being patient, keep hodling, keep stacking sats. We're moving at a crazy pace, and we're going to see some huge changes in money markets and in the foundations of finance. But what we need to make sure that we do as Bitcoiners, we need to choose our counterparty wisely. And I think that's where People's Reserve comes in. We are Bitcoin maxis building for Bitcoin maxis. You're going to get multi-sig. You're going to get no rehypothecation. You're going to get things that make sense and solve problems that Bitcoiners are facing. I don't think the banks are going to be looking at it that way. They're going to be looking at it as a new line of revenue, and they are going to be willing to put your pristine collateral at risk through rehypothecation and other market making things that they do, to where if something goes wrong, they'll do what they always done. They'll go back to the government, they'll go back to the Fed, and they say, hey, we made a mistake. It didn't turn out the way we thought it was going to turn out. We need money. But you know what's going to happen to all those people who put their money, and when I say money, I mean Bitcoin, with the bankers? When that finally happens, and I hope it doesn't, but you know, doing the same thing and expecting different results is the definition of insanity. So when they start custodying Bitcoin and doing the same thing, I'm going to expect the same results, not different results. So when it finally happens, unfortunately, what's going to happen to those people who trusted those bankers is they're going to be in the same situation as they were with FTX. They're just going to be creditors. And by the way, whenever that liquidation problem takes place, the same thing that happened to the FTX customers is going to happen to you. So if Bitcoin goes to $1 million, that everything's going really well, and then all of a sudden it falls down to $450,000, and now the banks are getting margin called, and it turns out they don't have the Bitcoin. Well, at $450,000, you'll get paid the dollars for the Bitcoin you had on deposit. But what you don't know is the same thing that happened to FTX. A month and a half, 2 months later, it's not at 450 anymore. It's back up at 800 or 900. But you're still being compensated at the 450 level from when the problem took place. And you're being compensated in dollar terms with what they can print, not with your Bitcoin that you were expecting and anticipating to get back. So when you finally get that cash, I think the FTX settlement is going out on like February 18th. So imagine all those people who lost it at 16,000 and they had 10 Bitcoin, and now they're getting $160,000 back because they're getting paid back on that liquidation value, not the market price. And now they have to buy back their Bitcoin. They can only buy 1.6 Bitcoin. They had 10, now they have 1.6 because they were creditors and they were in a fractional reserve rehypothecation system that collapsed. So we have to be really careful with who we choose as our counterparty to make sure they're applying the right banking practices that make sense on a Bitcoin standard.
100%. Preston Pysh made a post about this. He talked about potentially needing to ban rehypothecation on Bitcoin in order to prevent this stuff from happening. I tend to think that obviously that needs to happen, but I think there's a natural deterrent to rehypothecate Bitcoin, given that you can't print more of it. If a sudden banking collapse occurs, there's no facility that can be created to, make that Bitcoin whole again, right? There isn't a central entity that can create more Bitcoin in order to make these banks whole after they lose it all, like there is with the US dollar. And so I think banning rehypothecation is one thing. Choosing your counterparty very wisely is another. But I just think that because of Bitcoin's monetary properties, it's going to disincentivize banks from playing dirty tricks with it. Some will, but the ones that do, if they blow up, they'll blow up big, and then it will continue to disincentivize other banks from rehypothecating Bitcoin. Do you think that that's going to be the course of action? Do you think that's how this is going to take place? Or do you think that human greed is just too big? They're going to try to play their same old tricks with Bitcoin, when things go south, because it's a very volatile asset, it's moving several thousand dollars a minute behind me, they'll get wrecked, right? How do you think this is going to play out? What do you think banks are going to do? Are they going to treat this asset differently, or are they just going to do the same old thing that they always have done?
Well, I think they're going to do the same old thing that they've already, that they've always done. But I also think that they're ready to fight against the people who are going to try to do it differently. And who comes to mind is Caitlin Long with Custodia Bank. You know, why don't they have a Fed Master account? Because if you have a fully reserved bank and someone who has access to those markets, then every single deposit in the system will be obligated. It's not just that they'll choose to move. It'll be that the risk metrics will force the board to corporately resolve that it doesn't make sense to keep our money in a fractional reserve position when it can be in a fully reserved position with access to the same markets and products and services. So they have to ostracize her, right? They can't give you a fully reserved one-to-one access to repo markets through Custodia Bank when you're fully reserved, because no other bank is going to offer that full reserve. And then that creates a crisis within itself, which goes right back to the Bank Term Funding Program. Depositors wanted to move their monies from the banks into the money market funds so that they could get the higher rate of return from the money market fund versus the deposit at the bank. Well, the problem is that the asset or the government security that was backing the customer's deposit liability, the mark-to-market value was significantly lower. So assets were lower than liabilities. You could not liquidate the treasuries you had bought and recover the funds that you needed to send it over to the money market, because the bank can't just send the liability. It needs to send the corresponding asset to the money market. And that's what it couldn't do. So the government had a print to make up for that. And I think that's what's going to happen here again. And their mindset is you cannot have a non-fractional reserve bank and make money. But look no further than Tether to understand, who just announced the other day that they made $13 billion. That's an immense amount of money, especially for the amount, relative to the amount of employees they have. So you're talking about a company with maybe 100 employees who made $13 billion. That's more than some of the big banks that you see here in the United States. Now, it's not as much as the G-SIBs, but it's double digits in the billions is a lot of profit. And it's from a non-fractional reserve system. But Tether owns a huge chunk of U.S. treasuries, and those treasuries back the stablecoin. And it's a cash equivalent. And if you look on their transparency page, there are some other things there too, which is very interesting, because Senator Bill Hagerty, I believe he's from Tennessee, he just came out and announced that a genius act. And I just saw today on X on my way into the studio, and it's a stablecoin bill. Well, he had also issued the first version of a stablecoin bill maybe like 2 years ago. So this is a new updated version that probably there's some negotiations going on in the background to get in there what they wanted to get in there. But what it calls for is cash and cash equivalents to back stablecoins. So USDT might have to create some kind of special USA USD version that will go to that law if that law gets passed, because we know that they do have some commercial paper. They do have a lot of Bitcoin holdings, and some of that, not a large amount of it, but some of it is used to back that circulating token. So it's an interesting thing to see the stablecoin market develop at the same time that we're having this fractional reserve conversation, because indeed you can have a non-fractional reserve entity and be quite profitable. And that means that there's less risks for the consumers, and that honestly, in the decentralized internet economy, there's more opportunity. This is why people like Larry Fink of BlackRock are coming out and calling for the SEC to approve tokenization of assets. Did you see Trump talked about the American Sovereign Wealth Fund, and Secretary Bessent came out and said, we are going to monetize the asset side of the United States balance sheet to empower we the people. And we are going to bring forth these assets to empower we the people. This is an amazing thing that's happening right now. Truly, the foundations of finance are being shaken and rattled. But now's the time to have this conversation. Now's the time to look back on what has happened in banking history from fractional reserves, what good has come from it through that circulating credit that circulates that's not backed by any reserves. And then what options do we have moving forward? And when you look at Bitcoin, where it's a commodity credit, it's not a circulating credit market, it's a commodity credit market, meaning that each circulating credit unit is actually backed by a reserve like Bitcoin, so it's fully collateralized. That eliminates a lot of risk for lenders. And those lenders could ultimately be the depositors to that institution, because the institution, the practice of banking, would still remain intact. You would take depositors' deposits and you would lend them out to borrowers, but you would do it in a way where you were not over leveraged, where you were not in a position where if all of that money came back at the same time, you wouldn't be able to give the money back to people who are demanding their deposits. And that is a healthier, safer system and foundation to build an economy on than this fractional reserve system. So I hope this becomes part of the wider conversation. And even if it doesn't, people like Caitlin and Custodia Bank and people like People's Reserve are going to be moving forward using these business ideas and practices to offer a better, safer product for the consumer, for the borrower, and ultimately for the lender as well.
Absolutely. Let's go back to talking about Bitcoin as pristine collateral. It's something that's been floated several times, this concept. I'm not sure our viewers fully grasp it. You describe Bitcoin as the most pristine form of collateral in the world. It's in your X bio, which is fantastic. I love it. You know, really holding up the bullhorn on that. What makes Bitcoin superior to traditional forms of collateral like real estate and treasuries?
Yeah, fantastic question. And the answer to this is amazing, really. And we look back, what has been the most pristine form of collateral before 71 was really gold. And that's because it had that hardness to it. It was something that when someone was borrowing against it, they knew, hey, you know, this is liquid. There's global demand for it. This makes it a good form of collateral. But the problem was it was very expensive to transport, secure, and settle. Sometimes it would cost more to transport, secure, and settle the gold than it would to even borrow against it. So it didn't make sense. It created a problem. And then the solution to that problem, unfortunately, was seen as just paper. And we saw U.S. Treasuries really escalate quickly, fulfilling this collateral position because the security and the settlement were extremely cheap. I mean, pennies on the dollar relative to gold. Imagine you're settling $1 billion worth of securities with somebody across the world. Well, if you're doing that on a Web2 ledger, you type a couple things in and trusted counterparties, it's done for pennies on the dollar. But with gold, you got to secure it. You got to transport. The costs are tremendous. The problem is with those U.S. treasuries, it created a new problem. It lost the hardness of the gold. It could be created at will. It could be expanded at the whim of a politician or at the slamming of a gavel of a government agency or at a bank extending credit. There was no limit to how it was the most softest thing you could replace it with. But then comes Bitcoin and you say, well, why Bitcoin? What makes it pristine? Because you get the best of both worlds. You get the best of gold because it takes the hardness and it makes it better with absolute digital scarcity. But then you take the easy, cheap, secure settlement from the treasuries and boom, it's right on top of that. You can see on the blockchain, people send billions of dollars of Bitcoin for just a couple bucks and they only have to wait 10 minutes for this thing to settle. So getting the best of what gold offered plus what treasuries offer now creates this new hybrid pristine collateral that we call Bitcoin, which gives you absolute digital scarcity, cheap, easy, and secure settlement. And it's amazing when you take this pristine collateral and you start to plug it into credit and debt products, it changes the dynamics of how you measure risk and how you measure credit. And as you were saying earlier, all of a sudden, what becomes a risky proposition to potentially develop a property or to build a business or to even just buy a home becomes significantly less risky because we've taken pristine collateral and integrated it into the debt product. So it's no longer based on promise. It also has a proof of work backing.
Fantastic. I think that was a great explanation for people who may not understand the concept, right? It has that saleability across space that treasuries have, but it has that hardness, that saleability across time that gold has. It is the best form of collateral ever invented. It's what Bitcoin's monetary properties have always allowed it to do, but the market has treated it like the NASDAQ. And it seems like we're at the cusp of that finally turning around, Bitcoin moving down the risk curve, away from being NASDAQ adjacent and into the bucket that gold and USTs currently occupy. I love it. I want to ask you about Bitcoin-backed mortgages. You tweeted, and it's in your pinned tweet, about Bitcoin-backed mortgages with lower interest rates. Can you walk us through how a mortgage structured around Bitcoin collateral would work in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So the best thing about Bitcoin as collateral is that it reduces risk. And in a true free market, the interest rate is based not only on the supply of money and the demand for loans, but also the perception of counterparty risk. So that's why you get assigned a credit score. Credit scores are there to define the perception of risk of that borrower. And the higher the credit score, the less risky. The lower the credit score, the more risky. And your interest rate will actually adjust based on the perceived risk the lender has on lending you the money. So Bitcoin comes in and says, okay, you know what? we are going to, you know, especially if you are able to over collateralize your position. So for people who have been in Bitcoin for a while and you have been responsibly saving the most pristine form of collateral in the world, and now you want to try to benefit from your saving, but you want to do it in a way where you don't give up ownership and you don't create a tax obligation. Well, then what you can do is you'll post it as collateral. And from the lending perspective, let's say you want to buy a $1 million house, you're going to put $200,000 down, but then you're going to post $1 million of Bitcoin collateral. So basically what happens is if you default on the mortgage, the lender, we don't have to go through the foreclosure process. What people don't understand is that the foreclosure process is very tedious. It could take up to 18 months, sometimes even more, to foreclose on a property. And then the costs that are associated with that, just the lawyer fees alone that are associated with that, everything takes away from the principal and from what you can recover from that property. And the thing is that most of these LTVs, these loan to value ratios, when you buy a property, are very close to the market price on the property. But as we can see right now, I saw an example from ReVenture, which is a fantastic real estate app that I recommend people check out. They track some BlackRock portfolios. Here in the state of Florida, BlackRock had a sale listed for $420,000, single family home, four bedrooms, around 2,000 square feet. It just sold the other day for $360,000. So they took a significant cut. BlackRock took a significant cut on the principal value of the property in order to exit the position. And the real estate market right now with such high interest rates is really stagnant. Even with the Fed lowering the federal funds rate, that's okay. That's an anchor rate to the front end of the yield curve. It's the prime rate, it's that 10-year rate that is going to be an anchor rate for mortgages, which actually is doing the opposite of what the Fed is doing. So there's some interesting dynamics on the yield curve and in the credit markets at play right now, which are leading to a stagnating real estate market where I think demand is there, but it just can't act on what it wants to demand because the price isn't right and the costs are too high to finance, and you're just not going to get the volume. So when you don't have volume, it's just like those mark-to-market securities. It's like, hey, when we don't need to mark them to market, we have no problem when we can look at it at par value. Yeah, but the problem is that the market price is the price. And when you need the money, you have to get the market price. You don't get the par value, right? Hence the bank term funding program where you get the par value when you post it as collateral. Same thing with real estate. The mark-to-market value is not the comps that you're getting around. BlackRock listed their house for $420. It sold for $360. So what is your house worth? What is that collateral worth? Bitcoin is a liquid market, 24/7, 365. If you post $1 million of Bitcoin collateral, defaults on the mortgage, we can take that principal plus penalty from the Bitcoin and get it immediately. 24 access, and within 10 minutes, we have transformed the Bitcoin collateral back into dollars to recover the principal plus penalties or fees of the default. That risk reduction actually can help lower interest rates as well, because interest rates are geared to measure for that risk. It's the interest paid on top of the principal that is makes up for the potential of default. Because when you have a book, you write multiple loans. So if somebody defaults, the interest rate that somebody else continues to pay helps to make up for that default. So I think, you know, what's amazing is the Federal Reserve and even the current administration, they want interest rates lower. How do we get interest rates lower? Well, not by using price controls and having a small group of men state the interest rate lower. It's by letting the credit markets evolve. It's by upgrading the credit markets, by integrating the most pristine form of collateral we've ever seen with Bitcoin. And when you do that, you can reduce risk for the lenders. And when you reduce risk for the lenders, you can lower interest rates. The other thing that it does, which is pretty amazing, is that depending on what type of product you use, like here at People's Reserve, we have a self-repaying mortgage, which is kind of what I just described. But we also have a home equity Bitcoin line of credit for people who want to transform their home equity to Bitcoin equity, right? Maybe you already bought your home 10 years ago and you've been making payments, but the value of your house, you bought it for $200,000, is now worth $500,000. And you have $300,000 of trapped equity that you can't access without creating a liability on your balance sheet by borrowing against it from the bank. But you're not getting it at good rates. But what you could do is you could take out that equity and you transform your home equity into Bitcoin equity, and that Bitcoin is held as collateral in the HELOC contract, which also reduces risk for the lender. So you also have the Bitcoin powered mortgage, which is something where you don't have any Bitcoin and you don't have any home, but you want to buy the home and you have strong credit and you have a good balance sheet, and you want to incorporate Bitcoin into the contract. So you want to buy a $500,000 home, but you're going to borrow $650,000, and $150,000 is going to go directly into Bitcoin and be held in escrow as collateral in the mortgage to help achieve that lower interest rate, because that's what the goal is here. The goal is to make things more affordable. We're facing an affordability crisis. And when you add more risk with interest rate volatility, the current soft default that's going on with the United States government budget deficit, the potential for a hard default or complete renegotiation from the current administration on government debt instruments, all of that risk pushes yields up. It doesn't pull them down. But when you integrate Bitcoin, naturally yields can start to fall because the amount of risk within the system falls. And that's what the bankers and the government really need to understand. Like you said, this is not a risk on tech stock. This is the most pristine form of collateral in the world. This is engineered money. And when we incorporate it into our credit and debt markets, we can get the lowest interest rates in the world and attract tremendous amounts of liquidity from really highly qualified borrowers. The first country and the first states to do this are going to see a tremendous influx of demand for their debt notes and for their securities, because it's not only from the lender side, it's from the borrower side too. And when the borrowers are taking, think of this, if you get like a, I told you I'm down here in Naples, Florida, the beautiful city of Naples, very wealthy community, very successful people, pretty high taxes, but the city is successful. They have a AAA credit rating. You could imagine a municipal Bitcoin bond being issued by the city of Naples. There'd be significant amounts of demand from capital markets looking to get exposure to AAA credit that at the same time has exposure to Bitcoin, and can turn that 6% yield that Naples is willing to pay into potentially 12 or 18% because the performance of Bitcoin contributes to the yield of the municipal Bitcoin bond. And in return, the city of Naples gets tremendous amount of influx of liquidity to build out infrastructure, to take care of your firefighters and your policemen and your EMTs and your teachers, to upgrade the schools and public transportations, to do things that, honestly, with the amount of money that we've spent in this country, we should already be seeing. But now we can see it from the state level rather than the federal level.
100%. Absolutely. It's transformative, right? It's completely transformative for finance, particularly global credit markets. I want to shift gears into this recent FASB accounting rule change. Basically, right, in a nutshell, these companies who have wanted to hold Bitcoin on their balance sheets have been forced to mark them down as liabilities. Not only that, but they can't actually mark the gains on their balance sheet. Whenever there's a loss, they have to mark it down. When there's a gain, they can't mark it. And so it creates unnecessary volatility on these companies' balance sheets, and it discourages these CFOs from considering a Bitcoin allocation. Now that that's changed, now that people are not only allowed to hold it as an asset, but also they're allowed to mark it at fair market value, right? What does that mean for the corporate treasury strategy in the United States? Are more companies going to be adopting this as a reserve asset? Is it going to explode in popularity? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is hilarious because, and this is just another way, this is another example of the weaponization of the system, because the banks were in the opposite position, right? They hold the government debt securities, the treasuries, as the asset to back the demand deposit liability. And when the interest rate goes up and the mark-to-market value goes down, they don't need to use the mark-to-market value. They can still account for it at the par value on their balance sheet. So they can ignore losses. But when it comes to Bitcoin companies, we have to do the opposite. We actually have to ignore the gains and admit the losses. So what this does is it finally sets the record straight and allows companies who decide to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet to allow the earnings from that treasury asset to flow through the balance sheet. And right now it's only allowed to flow through in a negative way. Much like the banks are not allowed to, they're not allowed to flow through in a negative way. They hold positive. Bitcoin treasuries have to flow through in a negative way. They can't flow through positive. It's opposite. Now we're getting back to a level playing field. Now we're getting back to analysts who cannot figure out what the hell's going on at MicroStrategy. How are we in the middle of an artificial intelligence boom, and the company that is providing the shovels for the boom, NVIDIA, is not outperforming MicroStrategy? How's that possible? Like, I thought the AI company was supposed to be the evil overlord company who rules the world, but it's Michael Saylor who's actually had the most successful performing equity in the world since 2020. So something special is going on here. And when the balance sheet is allowed to recognize that special action that's taken place, which is the 60% CAGR or 60% compounding annual growth rate on the Bitcoin asset itself, and that passes through the balance sheet, I think companies like Microsoft, who disrespected Michael Saylor with 3 minutes of their time, are going to be really upset that 99.5% voted against such an amazing idea to take some of those quickly diluting debt derivative currency fiat trash notes and turning some of them into, just to start with, right? Just a little bit, just some of them into this pristine form of collateral, which will form the foundations and the base layer of finance as we move into the next age of what's really happening here. And the last thing I'll say about this, because I think, you know, this feeds into People's Reserve Bitcoin bond product, which is really just a principal protected note. I see these articles coming out where it's like, you can get exposure to Bitcoin with 20% downside, 30% downside, and 16 and 17% downside. You know, this is the future. I'm sorry, I disagree. I think what the future is 100% downside protection with infinite upside. How do you do that? Not with options and very complex strategies, just by simply integrating Bitcoin into the debt product itself. And in a principal protected note, that's exactly how we structured the note. And typically what happens is, depending on the interest rate that the note is issued at, it's around an 80-20 split. So if you did a $1 billion issuance, $800 million would go into US Treasury notes 5-year at around 4.5%, and then $200 million would go directly into spot Bitcoin. But over the course of the 5-year principal protected note, that $800 million at 4.5% matures at $1 billion value. So the principal amount of $1 billion that was invested into the product is secured by the full faith and credit of the United States government and the power of its printer. And that's what a lot of these big companies are looking for. Now, when they print that money and give it to you, you're confident that they can print it and give it to you, but you don't know what the heck you're going to be able to buy. But that's the same risk that you face in every other debt instrument. But when you add Bitcoin, that's what's left over, right? So the $800 million matures at $1 billion, your principal is protected. What's left over? How did that $200 million of Bitcoin perform? Is it down 50% in 5 years? There's no precedent for that. But what if it was? Well, then it would mature at $1.1 billion. That's 10% in 5 years. In simple interest terms, that's 2% APY. So how about 100% downside protection with infinite upside? That is what a principal protected note offers. And I think this is actually going to redefine how corporate treasuries work. Because, and maybe not for the big level, let me make that clear. I think for huge corporations like Apple and Microsoft, who are sitting on so much cash, you just buy Bitcoin because it's not going to hurt your business. You're diversifying your savings and you're putting it into the most pristine form of collateral. Go ahead and snag the 60% CAGR. Absolutely. But especially for small and medium-sized businesses, it cannot be overstated how important it is for a small and medium-sized business to be able to reinvest the revenue of the company to expand the company. I mean, I'm not aware of any small or medium-sized business that has a significant portion of savings on the side that it can keep in Bitcoin and that it can say, well, you know, I don't need access to that liquidity. That's my saving for the next 10 years. There's not many small and medium-sized businesses that are in a position to say, oh, I've started my savings account for the next 5 to 10 years. No, you're too busy building out your business, reinvesting that revenue and profit into expanding the business, finding the right employees, making the right partnerships, and growing the business. So how can I do that? How can I expand my business and grow my business, but at the same time get exposure to Bitcoin? Easy. People's Reserve Bitcoin bonds. Because that principal protected note is going to be on your balance sheet with 100% downside protection, but at the same time, it maintains the exposure to the best performing asset in the world. And these notes, if Bitcoin can keep up its 60% CAGR, you're talking about 40% APY over 5 years in that note. If the CAGR gets cut in half to 30%, you're talking about 20% APY. So imagine a business who can keep a product on their balance sheet that produces 20 to 40% APY. And by the way, if you have a Bitcoin bond, People's Reserve, we value that as pristine collateral. So you could also post that as collateral and borrow against it without giving up the equity on your balance sheet. You can now expand your business, hire a new employee, take on a new partnership, and eat those costs without giving up the equity value on your balance sheet and just creating a small liability in the form of a debt and then using the cash flow from your business to pay down that debt. Now you got the best of both worlds. You maintain your equity value on your balance sheet with the exposure to Bitcoin, but you have the expansion or the employee or the partnership come through as well. The future of finance is being built around Bitcoin equity, and truly, there's no limit to the application of these different tools that are going to be popping up, not only from People's Reserve, but from the different things that MicroStrategy is creating too. We saw the preferred offering come out. There's so many pools of capital that need access for one way or another. The problem is not universal. It's very niche, but there's $300 trillion sitting on the sidelines right now in negative real rates of return. And there's many different pools of capital in these different niches that have a, they need a solution. Sometimes it's going to be a convertible debt note. Sometimes it's going to be equity. Sometimes it's going to be a preferred offering. Sometimes it's going to be a Bitcoin bond. Sometimes it's going to be a principal protected note. We don't know all the different problems and how we can solve them, but we do know that the forward-looking companies that are looking at these solutions now, they're going to rise to the top. They're going to be at an advantage. And eventually, every single business will be forced to adopt Bitcoin or be outcompeted.
That's exactly right, CJ. And what you mentioned, you know, about transformative companies that try to unlock all this money that's just out there sitting on the sidelines getting a negative real rate of return. You mentioned home equity. We're building something very similar. And this is a topic of discussion for another day, perhaps you and I offline, but definitely another podcast. I want to talk to you about this. You guys have a similar product, it sounds, that you're building at the People's Reserve. We're building a very similar one with Theia. Theia, we're launching a new kind of sub product called Horizon, basically to allow homeowners to unlock that latent home equity to diversify into BTC. And that's one pool of capital. It's like $30, $35 trillion in the US. And it's just sitting there. And that home equity, people are more often, like literally 78% of homeowners, their biggest, you know, asset that they have is their house. Can't do anything with it. They're locked into, if you're in a bad market, like a 2% appreciation. If you're in a really good market, 5 to 6% appreciation yearly. That's half the S&P 500. That's 1/6 or 1/7 of Bitcoin's CAGR right now over 4 years. And so I 100% agree with you. The companies that explore these structured financial products and that incorporate Bitcoin into them, including some of these banks that are going to get on board, these traditional banks, but also brand new institutions like the People's Reserve, like Custodia Bank, right? They are going to be the financial institutions of the future. The final thing I want to ask you about is where Bitcoin's headed over the next several years because of this. Obviously, you know, you're very active on Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter. A lot of developments around Bitcoin right now, not just from the standpoint of how it's changing from a regulatory perspective, but also, you know, from a price standpoint, countries, right? Today, literally just before we hopped on, David Sacks talked about a strategic Bitcoin reserve. He said one of the first things that our working group was tasked with by President Trump was exploring the feasibility of a strategic Bitcoin reserve. He didn't use the digital assets moniker that was in the executive order. He said strategic Bitcoin reserve several times with a B, capital B. And so, you know, where do you think Bitcoin's headed from a price standpoint over the next several years, should these things come to fruition?
Yeah, fantastic question. And what I've realized in my experience is typically people like you and I who take the deep dive, you know, we've gone to the bottom of the rabbit hole. We planted some TNT. We went deeper. We set up a man cave so that everybody can come and study with us and learn what we've learned. We typically tend to be a cycle or two ahead of everybody. And right now, it's digital gold. I think the narrative is digital gold. The narrative is strategic Bitcoin reserve. And strategic Bitcoin reserve is really based on the wider marketplace understanding Bitcoin as digital gold, which was like that was my first realization going back into like the 2016 halving. So like when I first found Bitcoin, I'm like, oh, magic internet money. And then finally, I'm like, oh, no, wait, digital gold. And then after the advent of DeFi and the ability to create a free market yield curve where the interest rates are not stated, I mean, the internet economy cannot be underestimated. It's the only economy in the world that has no debt. It's the only economy in the world that allows interest rates to be decided in a true free market fashion without any stated rate. And I think that's really the future of finance being built around Bitcoin. So anything competing with Bitcoin is a scam. Stay far away from it. But things, centralized and decentralized solutions being built around specifically Bitcoin, I believe are the future of finance. And what we're going to see is that the wider marketplace is just now starting to understand the digital gold narrative. Well, what does that mean? That means like 15 trillion market cap, right? 20 trillion market cap. So you're talking about gold, Bitcoin going to the price of 700 to maybe $1 million to get to the digital gold, depending on the price of gold, right? So somewhere between $750 and $1 million, and Bitcoin is now digital gold. But what people like you and me know and are building for is that Bitcoin is so much more than digital gold. It, like I said earlier, it's that engineered money. There was strategic design into the protocol itself to literally leverage the natural laws of economics to drive value into the network. This means it's an engineered money. And the engineered solution is always better than the natural solution. We had, what did we used to use? Candles, then we went to a light bulb. Then we had horsepower in the engine. So when you go from natural to engineered, it's always an upgrade. And Bitcoin is engineered money. It's the upgrade from the natural form of the money for all the reasons we spoke about today. But the total addressable market of engineered money, which is pristine collateral of the internet economy, the reserve asset of a aggregate economy of the world that no one country can control or outcompete, is multi-hundreds trillions of dollars. It's not just the $15 to $20 trillion market cap we see in gold as a way to store value. It is a foundations of finance marketplace. It is a multi-hundred trillion dollar marketplace. And I think, you know, ultimately that's where we go to. Now, are we a cycle ahead of that in my line of thinking? We very well may be. We might need to just get to digital gold first, let the banks make their fractional reserve mistakes, have a huge liquidation event where we learn those lessons the hard way. And then people finally start to understand, whoa, it's pristine collateral. They couldn't print it. BlackRock couldn't convince the network to double the supply, right? Like it actually is pristine collateral. And then we're going to move on. We're going to move so far beyond 15 to 20 trillion. We're going to move into the multi-hundred trillions in the long term. So stay true to your thesis. And if you don't have a thesis, study what Joe is doing, study what I'm doing, and solidify that thesis. And then keep the long-term mindset, right? Let Bitcoin change you, because that happens to everybody. We didn't come into Bitcoin automatically understanding all of this stuff. I shared with Natalie that so thus far, based on today's price of Bitcoin, I've paid $9 million in research and development for the self-repaying mortgage product because I was stupid enough to use my Bitcoin to buy my house, right? So, but learning that lesson led to the development of the product, which is going to help other people not have to learn that lesson. And that's kind of what I see happening. We have to get the digital gold. Those lessons need to be learned on a wider base. But once they are, Bitcoin is going to the place where just one coin is going to be able to create generational wealth for you and your progeny.
Wow. That's unbelievably bullish. One of the most bullish takes that I've heard. Didn't even require a price target, right? Because genuinely there isn't one, right? Particularly when we're denominating it in a currency that's faced with such a terrible situation like this.
Yeah. I'll give you a price target. Here you go. Oh, global beautiful. GDP divided by 21 million. Because that, you know, I love the infinity by 21 million. And here's where I define infinity. It's the potential production and creativity of humanity, right? It's the human element within the variable that can create and innovate, that drives value into the economy. So the limit on creativity is infinite. But ultimately, Bitcoin can fully represent global GDP divided by 21 million. And I think after that S-curve adoption, after we get the mainstream adoption, we haven't even had the mainstream adoption. Like I think like you and me, like we'll be like in pictures in our family's estates, like, oh, you know, there's great, 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 great grandpa Joe, man, he was buying Bitcoin when it was less than $100,000, you know, like just telling good stories about it, because it's so unbelievable where we are and how early we are right now. We're 15, 16 years into this. And just go look how long it took for some communities to move away from yapstones and from seashells. Look how long it took for us to figure that out. And within 16 years, we're now being financialized and monetized. This is absolutely a blinding pace. So definitely the tools that we need to hold on to our Bitcoin, which are the tools that recognize Bitcoin as pristine collateral, are going to be some of the most important products and services that pop up in the coming years, because those are the tools that are going to allow you to hold on to your Bitcoin and benefit from your Bitcoin as we go through this transfer of wealth. Because the transfer of wealth ultimately pushes us to global GDP divided by 21 million.
Extremely well said. Yeah, unbelievably bullish right there. You mentioned you paid, you know, $9 million for your house. I certainly wish I was buying Bitcoin when I was 10 instead of whatever I was doing, playing soccer. I don't know.
I lost 9 million. That's so far, right? When Bitcoin goes to 200,000, I would have lost.
You'll have lost 18 million. Yeah.
And it's like, no, it's too much. But learning that lesson created the self-repaying mortgage product. So now others don't have to learn that lesson. And I'm hoping and praying that the marketplace can learn some of these lessons from us Bitcoiners without having to learn the hard way. And if that's the case, we'll see acceleration faster than probably anybody is anticipating at this point.
Absolutely. Well said. Yeah. My two favorite phrases of the cycle are infinity over 21 million and accelerate, because we certainly are accelerating. CJ, before we sign off here, any parting thoughts that you want to leave the audience with?
Yeah. So we talk about all these lending products, like they're going to be a big deal, and they are. But I want to highlight one of the main reasons that why we're creating these products, because something amazing happens in the natural laws of economics when people realize Bitcoin has pristine collateral. And that is, in the natural laws of price discovery, typically a higher price leads to an increased supply. But something happens with Bitcoin, you can't increase the supply. So the higher price becomes the only way to incentivize the existing supply to be sold on the marketplace. However, when you can borrow against your Bitcoin, a higher price can actually not convince you to sell, because a higher price actually deleverages your debt position. So it just puts you in a stronger position. It does not incentivize selling. And if it goes too high, then it just incentivizes more borrowing. So what becomes the greatest risk in a world where the proper lending tools exist for Bitcoin? Liquidation. And Bitcoin price volatility can be used against the people by maybe a bank offering a 90% LTV instead of a more safer risk-averse lender offering maybe a 50 or 60% LTV. And you can find yourself in a position where, just like the other day, Bitcoin went down almost to 91,000. Now we're all the way back up. You could have been liquidated in that process if your LTV was not in the right range. And for these bigger players, these bigger market makers who don't care about you, liquidation is actually going to become the best way for them to accumulate coins, because a higher price actually will not incentivize you to sell. Only forced selling through liquidation will force you to sell and give up the most pristine form of collateral. So at People's Reserve, it's not necessarily borrowing against your Bitcoin. It's creating credit and debt products that integrate Bitcoin as a collateral component and remove that liquidation risk, because we don't want you to lose your Bitcoin. We don't want you to give up generational wealth for just one generation of housing. We want to make sure that we understand liquidation risk is real. It is probably the biggest risk faced for Bitcoiners over the coming two cycles. And we need to pick a counterparty who recognizes that and designs products to protect you from that risk. So just keep that in mind as this really starts to take off in the coming years.
Absolutely. Choose your counterparty wisely. The companies that are doing this right are going to be some of the biggest, most highly valued, sought after companies in the world, not just the United States. And you're exactly right. Nick, my colleague, tweeted out ages ago, he said, initially reminded me of this, and I actually see your comment under it. Satoshi broke economics with digital scarcity. No supply response destroys every model. And it's true. When the price of a commodity goes up, generally speaking, the supply response, that increase in demand, is a higher issuance schedule. Bitcoin's issuance schedule cannot be changed. That's the value prop. Understand it. Learn from our failures. Learn from our teachings as well. And of course, CJ, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you if they want to see more of your work?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. Like you said earlier, a big fan of your work and longtime follower. So it's great to be here. And I look forward to coming back again in the future, especially after People's Reserve is live. You can follow me on X at CJ Constantinos and, of course, at People's Reserve.
Fantastic. CJ Constantinos, thank you so much for coming on the Theia podcast. And of course, everybody, make sure to check out all of his work. Make sure to go to Theia.us if you want to self-custody your coins and the world's simplest Bitcoin self-custody solution. That's all for today. I'll talk to you soon.